The Sunstone Foundation presents Christian Insights on Contemporary Issues, recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the University of Utah campus, where the program is about to begin.
You can leave as much time for discussion as possible. I might mention that the presentations which Sister Rosemary and I will be making will be contrasting presentations. The one which I will be giving will be emphasizing our separating of ourselves from the value of the valuing the things of the world so that we can move home to God. And I think that Sister Rosemary will contrast this with a presentation which will emphasize our valuing the earth and the things, and not particularly the things of the world, the material things, but at least the earth and the things which God has given us in the earth. So my name is Tom Davies, and I'll give my presentation, which has kind of hastily been inserted, and then we'll turn the balance of the time over to Sister Rosemary, and I'll introduce her after I've given my presentation. My home awaits me. I will hasten there. If I so choose, I can depart this world entirely. It is not death which makes this possible, but it is a change of mind about the purpose of the world. If I believe it has value as I see it now, so will it still remain for me. But if I see no value in the world as I behold it, nothing that I want to keep as mine or search for as a goal, it will depart from me, for I have not sought for illusions to replace the truth. This is my lesson for today from a mystical book called A Course in Miracles, and is kind of an introduction to the paper, which I will read. In September of 1988, after months of secret negotiations, the Mormon Church purchased a small Trappist monastery in northern Utah. For some time, the church has recognized two needs which it hopes to begin to satisfy by this purchase. First is the need to become quietly involved in the growing ecumenical movement that is being experienced throughout the world, and second is the need of some of the members within the church for a place where they can go for varying periods of time to pray and meditate. The monastery will minister to both of these needs. It will be a place of retreat where groups made up of representatives from different religious traditions can meet to heal their differences in an atmosphere of love and mutual respect, and also a place where individual male members of the church can go to separate themselves from worldly activities and devote their time to prayer and meditation. The monks who reside at the monastery have agreed to remain in their traditional role. In addition, they will act as guides for those who come to learn the contemplative life. It is anticipated that some who go through this experience will elect to stay at the monastery and eventually replace the monks who are there through the process of attrition. The church is presently looking for a convent to purchase where women of the church can go to share in the same experience that the men in the church will have at the monastery. Religious groups who wish to use the facility as a retreat, as well as individual male members, should write or telephone the monastery directly for reservations. There will be a nominal fee for the use of the facility. No bishop's recommend is required. Now, as you listen to the above report, were you completely fooled by the content? This is unlikely, but what about it tipped you off that I was not describing a real event? Was it the statement of the church's desire to be involved in the ecumenical movement? The reported recognition by the church of a need for contemplation and meditation by some of its members? The cooperation with the monks at the monastery? The fact that the church would look for a similar environment for its female members? The failure to require a recommend, or simply the tone of my voice? If the monastery is not the source of Mormon monks and mystics that is the subject of this paper, where are they to be found? At the missionary training center? The Mormon temples? Or is there a contradiction? in terms between Mormon and monk and mystic. In this paper, I will suggest what it is to be a monk and a mystic, and will suggest that there is a sizable group in the church who fit into these two categories. Now, we are living at a critical time in history when the world seems to be hurling itself towards self-destruction. Everything is speeding up. Changes are occurring at a rate never before imagined. We are inundated with sensory input and are becoming increasingly impatient, wanting quick fixes for everything. We are expecting more and more out of others, and if they do not perform according to our expectations, we are quick to condemn. All around us, we see examples of the pressures which are being put upon our institutions and society. Our cities are becoming battlegrounds and decaying from the very foundation. Crime is becoming rampant. Our educational system is not providing an adequate education for large numbers of our population. The needs of the elderly are not being met. The environment is becoming ever increasingly polluted. Many natural resources are nearing depletion. We are a society which is ever demanding more and more, but enjoying what we get less and less. The solutions offered generally act only as band-aids without ever getting to the source of the problem. For example, the solution to increasing crime in society is to hire more law enforcement officers, educate more lawyers, and build more jails, courts, and prisons. Always the answer is to do more, to enlarge what already exists, or to make it more complex. There has always been an alternate solution, which has been to do less, to pull back to the way things were at the beginning, to simplify to the barest essentials of existence. This has been the way of the monks and mystics. I will shortly give examples of such men and women who have given up everything, their families, their possessions, and sexual companionship, leaving intact only their love of God and the faith that He would clothe, protect, and direct them. We have secretly envied these strange individuals. Literally millions of us throughout the world look at the aging and diminutive Teresa of Calcutta, also called Sister Teresa or Mother Teresa, as a virtuous woman who sets an example of what it is to be a true follower of Christ. And what of Jesus, our premier example, who apparently possessed only the clothes which he wore? Do we not admire him as much for his denial of worldly things as for his teachings? In many societies, the ones who are most revered are those who deny themselves the most, the hermits and ascetic gurus. Yes, we envy these individuals for the simplicity of their lives and their closeness to God, but we generally cannot find it within ourselves to emulate them, even though we know that if we could only do so, our lives would be much less complicated and stressful. The message which has been given and which I give is that we must get back to basics if we are ever to experience true peace, joy, and happiness. And what is more basic than God and our relationship with Him? We must become monks and mystics. Now, you may argue that this suggestion is very impractical, verging on ludicrous. My answer is that we are unwilling to make such a commitment because we value the things of the world more than we value the things of God. It is as simple as that. When we come to the point where we value the things of God more than the things of the world, we will, as a matter of course, divest ourselves of attachment to worldly things. There are a number of scriptures which we conveniently ignore, which tell us that we must do this very thing if we are to become disciples of Jesus and to inherit the same kingdom which he enjoys. Jesus approves of his disciples giving up everything to follow him, tells us to renounce our families and take up the cross if we are to be his disciples, that we must lose our life if we are to find it, that we should take no thought of what we eat or wear, and that we should lay up treasures in heaven and not on earth. The Apostle John tells us that we should not love the world or the things that are in it, for we cannot both love the world and God. To be a monk is to live in the world but not be of the world. Every monk practices some degree of self-denial. I might mention as an aside here that I'm using the male gender throughout this paper for continuity, but everything essentially that I say applies both to males and females. The two major religious traditions which practice the monastic life are Buddhism and Christianity. The monastic life within Buddhism began with Buddha. He and his disciples were monks. Prior to his enlightenment, Buddha practiced the most severe asceticism for 7 years, when he eventually recognized that such extreme denial was like trying to tie the air in knots and was not leading him to enlightenment. His enlightenment did come along with a realization of the truth when he withdrew within himself through an extended period of meditation. Subsequently, he taught a middle way for himself and his followers, which involved considerable self-denial, but acknowledged that adequate food and rest, along with clothing for the body, were necessary for the monk to fulfill his vocation effectively. Traditionally, the Buddhist monk's only property is a begging bowl and 3 robes. The monastic order in Christianity cannot be tied directly to Jesus in the same way that Buddha is to the Buddhist monastic life. While Jesus taught self-denial, as mentioned above, he associated freely with many different classes of people. No one that I am aware of looks upon Jesus as a monk, although he was a mystic, as we will discuss below. Why some Christians would turn to the monastic life is a question that perhaps can best be answered by the experience of Antony, believed by many to be a Christian monk. Antony, who lived in the 3rd and 4th centuries, was the son of a moderately wealthy Egyptian farmer who was also a Christian. His parents died when he was still a teenager, which left him to care for his sister. One day on his way to church, he was pondering the fact that the disciples gave up everything to become followers of Jesus. When he entered the church, the gospel was being read, specifically the part concerning the rich man, which says, "If thou wilt be perfect, go sell all thou hast, and give to the poor, and come follow me, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven." He immediately left the church, gave away some of his property to townspeople, sold the rest, giving the money he received to the poor. He kept only a small amount for his sister. When he again went to church, he heard the admonition, "Be not solicitous for the morrow." Again, he immediately left the church, gave away the balance of what he had, put his sister in the care of others, learned the life of an ascetic from the few that were available in the vicinity. After practicing asceticism near his village for a period of time, he crossed the Nile and locked himself up in an abandoned fort for 20 years. When he emerged, there was a crowd of people waiting to hear his words of wisdom. He gave a long speech on the monastic life, much like Buddha had given to his disciples, but was unable to tolerate the large crowds. He left the area and went to a more remote part of Egypt, where he spent the next 40 years until his death at age 105. While Antony was living as a hermit, a contemporary of his named Pachomius was organizing a monastic group from some of the men and women who were beginning to inhabit the desert. The society proved so successful that it was replicated a number of times, and by the time of Pachomius' death, there was a community of monasteries with approximately 7,000 monks. Basil of Caesarea, in the middle of the 4th century, took this concept developed by Pachomius and moved it into the city, where the monks could not only practice love for each other, but also be of service to the surrounding community. His monasteries included hospitals, orphanages, and schools. Probably the best-known Christian monk in modern times is Thomas Merton. At age 26, he went from being a recent college graduate to the life of a Trappist monk, one of the most restrictive of monastic orders. His autobiography of his conversion, The Seven Story Mountain, sold over 500,000 copies in a few months and propelled him and the monastic life into the consciousness of many Americans, as well as others throughout the world. He subsequently wrote over 60 books and traveled widely throughout the world, not a small order for a monk who took the vow of silence. It is from Thomas Merton that many of us have gained an appreciation for the contemplative life. A mystic is someone who experiences communion with the ultimate reality. There is no doubt, based on this definition, that Jesus was a mystic, especially as represented in the Gospel of John. For example, in the 17th chapter, Jesus speaks of his oneness with God and prays that his disciples might achieve this same oneness. Mysticism can be found within all the major world religions. In Hinduism and Buddhism, mysticism is a major thrust within the religion. In Judaism, the mystical thread is protected by the Kabbalists. In Islam, it is the Sufis. And in Christianity, the mystical tradition is safeguarded primarily by the monks and nuns within Catholicism and the Eastern Orthodox Church, as well as by a few individual Protestants. Although the details of mysticism may vary from religion to religion, all mystics promote the direct experience of the ultimate reality, whether it be God, Nirvana, Brahman, or someone or something else. Mystical union with God is a three-step process. The first step is purification. This should be contrasted with asceticism practiced by monks, as described earlier. The aspect of Christianity on which monks are inclined to dwell is the giving up of everything in order to obtain God's kingdom. Many have chosen the monastic life in the past because they thought that by so doing their salvation was assured. This was one of the major criticisms of the celibate life made by Martin Luther. When a monk stops at asceticism, he is failing to realize that it is a part of a continuing process. The monk who is a mystic, Thomas Merton is an example, realizes this and continues on beyond simple asceticism. For him, the purification process is the clearing out from the heart of all attractions other than the attraction to God. Only when he has done this can he experience the other two stages of enlightenment and unity with God. When a mystic experiences unity with God, he experiences God's pure love. He enters God's love, and God's love enters him. In the process, he loses his self-identity, and his will becomes God's will. From then on, his life is a life motivated by love and directed by the Holy Spirit. Enlightened individuals such as Buddha and Jesus have received the truth, which they then feel obligated to share with others. They should be distinguished from those who are chosen to receive a revelation or to act as a channel for a messenger of God. Examples of such individuals are Moses, Muhammad, Joseph Smith, and Helen Schuckman, channel for A Course in Miracles. The latter were not possessors of the truth, but rather conveyors of the truth, as it was directed through them. We frequently mistake the two and demand that the latter fulfill the function of the former. Marcia Sinatar recently wrote a book entitled Ordinary People as Monks and Mystics. In it, she describes some of the responses which she got to an advertisement she placed in several California newspapers and in a national magazine, which read as follows. Do you know someone who lives apart and likes it? Local author researcher wishes to interview unique individuals over age 35 who, despite life's ups and downs, live alone by choice in a positive, contributive relationship with other, possess a highly developed sense of aesthetics, ethics, and universal order, experience their work and or daily activity as devotional, a calling, or as service, have designed their lives to be as simple, orderly, and uncomplicated as possible. Also, legally married couples who fit this description would be ideal for participation in this lifestyle study. If you know of someone interested in participation, please ask him or her to review this ad and respond. From the responses to her ad, Sinatar identified a group of individuals who fit many of the characteristics of monks and mystics, which we have previously talked about. For the purpose of her study, Sinatar defined a monk as, and I quote, one who had detached emotionally from a known, familiar, and comfortable way of life in order to embark on an uncharted inner journey. The monk responds to an inner call, reinterprets his basic way of being in the world, which might include reinterpreting the way he relates to others, work, marriage, church, or other organizational status, and even includes a renewed definition of himself, his basic place, and his basic place in the scheme of things, unquote. She also speaks of these individuals as socially transcendent. One does not have to take vows or live within the strict rules of a monastery in order to break with conventional life, according to Sinatar. Sometimes it involves a perceptual shift, a change in a person's way of thinking, which determines the way he sees and reacts to others. As a person starts to question his previous way of life and to establish a new direction, he not infrequently experiences a detachment, as if he is looking upon his life from the outside, and a loss of meaning to life as the traditional points of reference are removed. This forces him to turn within and to start to rely on his own inner authority. Speaking of the individuals in her study, Sinatar concludes that, quote, "What all these people have in common is the ability to discern what they need and make appropriate life adjustments to accommodate to those needs. All intuitively and specifically knew what elements they wanted to alter in life in order to live more honestly. It is as if some new faculty or power develops within, a critical, thinking, observing faculty, which allows them to watch, editorialize, and know concretely what to do in their day-to-day living in order to be authentic and whole," unquote. The mystics, whom she describes as being self-transcendent, are those who, quote, "have perceived themselves to be a part of the whole and have experienced a radical transformation or mysterious union with another reality or with God," unquote. Love becomes dominant in their lives. People who have had near-death experiences frequently report that after their experience, they are more loving and giving than they were before the experience. Some make dramatic shifts in their lifestyle to accommodate their change in attitude towards others. I again quote Sinatar. The true mystic is not merely involved with esoteric thoughts or beautiful images of God in heaven. He is totally absorbed in a life movement, a journey in which his essential self, his real self, comes into life with and in God. This coming to God, as it has been called, is the journey. Its goal is to live in such a way that there is no distinction between daily activity, that is, one's business, chores like washing dishes or scrubbing floors, walking in the streets, shopping, and so forth, and prayer, worship, or remembrance of God. In other words, the true mystic desires that his life be subsumed in and with the presence of God, unquote. Some of us are not ready for the peace, joy, and happiness that oneness with God can bring. Like the prodigal son, we still have friends and money to spend. That is, we still get a lot of pleasure out of worldly things. The prospect of being in a state where we are continually at peace can sound boring. Conflict, competition, challenge, even war hold more of an attraction for us. Life is fun and games. But we should realize that this is a decision we make, that we are either consciously or unconsciously subjecting ourselves to the voice of the ego. Eventually, we will all run out of money and our friends will depart. At that point in time, we will start thinking about home and how good it would feel to be with our Father again. Even if as a servant, it is inevitable. And those who have already returned home must be patient and wait for this to occur. Jesus is one such person. What must be done by those who are ready to return home to God? How does one become a monk and a mystic, if not literally, at least figuratively? First, there must be a desire. In fact, this may be all that is necessary. But since this sounds a little too simple, let us give some other things to do. A second step is that we must find a path. Now, it really doesn't matter what the path is as long as it is one which takes us home. It can be Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, or any one of a number of other paths. The important thing is that we get on a path which is right for us. Third, we must walk the path and stay on the path, overcoming any obstacles that we find along the way. There's an old Indian saying, if you want to find water, you do not dig 100 holes 1 foot deep, but rather one hole 100 feet deep. We must each plumb the depths of our own belief, and there we will find our true self, which we will discover is but a reflection of God. Fourth, we must be willing to accept the fact that it is our self, our false self, our ego, which is keeping us from home. Once we believe in ourself, our true self, that aspect which was created by God, and identify with that self, then we will instantly be home. This process involves the realization that this world is an illusion perpetrated by the ego, and the giving up of the ego, becoming egoless, followed by a transformation in which the world as we know it disappears to be replaced by a world which more closely approximates what it is like to be with God. God loves each of us equally, and he has provided a path for each of us whereby we can return home. The path that is right for you may be different from the path that is right for me. What is essential is that we each eventually find our path and that we learn to respect each other's path. It goes without saying that there is no tradition within Mormonism for either monasticism or mysticism, although there have been a number of reported mystical or spiritual experiences in the church, especially in the early years. An increasing interest in the subject has developed over the past several years. David Peck published an article on Mormonism and Eastern mysticism in an issue of Dialogue for 1988. And in the same year, the Sunstone Symposium included a panel on mysticism approaches for Latter-day Saints. Showing considerable courage, one of the panel members, Virginia Burgess, shared a mystical experience which she had had with the audience. A recent issue of Sunstone Magazine contains an article by Mark Koltko on mysticism and Mormonism, an LDS perspective on transcendence and the higher consciousness, which is a version of a paper read at both the 1987 Washington and Salt Lake Sunstone Symposiums. Those of us who are familiar with the lifestyle of Hugh Nibley, who is being honored at this symposium, would, within the context of the definition of monk given in this essay, likely consider him to be a monk. Some of the recent publications by Ed Firmage on Mormon subjects are increasingly mystical in content as he attempts to encourage Mormons, along with other Christians, to take seriously Christ's admonition that we love everyone and that we involve ourselves in the reconciliation process, especially his most recent paper, which was read at the Cathedral of the Madeleine and is found in the latest edition of Dialogue magazine. Mormons who are monks and mystics will perceive the world differently than other Mormons. In particular, when reading Scripture, they will look for the deep or esoteric meaning in what they read rather than taking the Scripture literally. Likewise, ritual will take on a deeper meaning than is commonly understood by most members of the church. They will pray as if they are actually talking with God and will meditate with the expectation that they will experience God. Doctrine will not be taken for granted, but will be studied in an attempt to determine its original intent, as well as the degree to which it agrees with the perennial philosophy. They will rely more on the inner authority of the Holy Spirit than the external authority. Some examples of how they may interpret Scripture, ritual, and doctrine differently are as follows. Number one, baptism may be looked upon as symbolic of the death of the natural man, that is, the ego, and the birth of the spirit man. Likely, this transformation will not occur at the time of the act of baptism and may never take place. Two, the sacrament of the Lord's Supper may be seen as symbolic of the taking of Christ into ourselves or becoming Christed. That is, the realization that at the spirit level, we are actually Christ, the Son of God. Three, the temple may be seen as symbolic of the temple that is within each of us, not the body, but the mind and spirit. It is here that we can approach the altar where we meet God. This generally occurs through the process of meditation. Four, Zion, rather than referring to a place, may be perceived as a state of mind in which we lose our personal identity and become one with God and our fellow beings. This comes about through the process of purification. Most of the prophets will be perceived as mystics, while dreams and events involving loss of normal consciousness, such as with the Apostle Paul, Lehi, Nephi, Alma the Younger, and so forth, will be looked upon as mystical experiences. This will also be true of the events that occurred at the time of Jesus' appearance to the Nephites, in which the disciples and children were taken up into heaven where they had an indescribable experience. This experience was probably similar to the unity with God experience of mystics, as described above, and the attraction to the light experience related by many who have had near-death experiences. The subsequent 165-year period in which there was no contention in the land because of the love of God which did dwell in the hearts of the people will be explained in terms of the transformation that took place, wherein the people lost their own self-identity and will and were directed completely by God's will. Only thus could they have completely resisted the temptations of Satan and live for such an extended period of time in a sinless state. Today we have talked about monks and mystics who, while living alone or in groups, have experienced some of the peace, joy, and happiness that we are all looking for. We have also talked about ordinary people who have so structured their lives that functionally they are living as monks and mystics. There are several conclusions which we can draw from all of this. One, we have been sold a bill of goods by the ego when we think that more is better. At some point in time, we must drastically reduce our level of consumption in order to return to a more simple... Let me say that again. At some point in time, we must drastically reduce our level of consumption and return to a more simple existence. We must do this for two reasons. The first is because Mother Earth cannot indefinitely give of herself for our selfish convenience. The second is because we cannot serve both God and mammon. Or put in another way, we cannot experience two worlds. Either we are for God or we are against God. If we want God, we must give up the things that keep us from God. If we want the things of the ego, then we should not expect God to become involved in our illusion. Two, as each individual surrounds himself with excess paraphernalia, so does each religion surround itself with excess doctrine, ritual, and ethics. In each instance, the purpose of the excess is to satisfy the demands of the ego. If we are to find the real God or essence both within religion and ourselves, we must strip away all the excess. When we do this, I think that in every instance, we will find love at the core. If we don't, then we are dealing with a false religion. Three, sustained peace, joy, and happiness does not come specifically from being in a particular place or with a particular group of people. Rather, it is a state of mind. We do not have to enter a monastic community or be a hermit to become a monk or mystic. We must merely change our mind from being ego-centered to being God-centered. The content of our thoughts will show us how successful we have been in making this change. Four, a certain period of time each day should be devoted to communion with God through study, prayer, and meditation. I think this is an individual, private thing. This personal time with God provides us with the energy we need to go out into the world and share God's love through service to our fellow beings, whether it be our family, our associates at work or school, our specific involvement in service projects, or simply someone we meet incidentally in the course of our goings and comings. Five, periodically it can be strengthening and helpful to meet with others who have a like mind. Furthermore, the home environment is not always the most conducive place for prayer and meditation, especially if it extends longer than a few hours. There would be value in having places of retreat where people can go for this purpose. Six, we must be patient. God's time is not our time. 37 years ago, I knelt in a secluded spot and prayed to know the truth, much as I imagined Joseph Smith did, expecting immediate communication with God. It did not happen then, and I still have not had that experience, but there are times during contemplative prayer when I feel his presence to be very near. During these 30-some-odd years, I have been against God more than I have been for him, and yet his love for me has remained constant. I have felt the direction of the Holy Spirit in finding a path that is meaningful to me. I have tasted of some of the fruit along the path and found it to be delicious. I expect the path to take me home to God. What God has done for me, he will do for each of his children. All one has to do is sincerely say, Father, I want to come home. We're now going to have the opportunity of listening to Sister Rosemary. Sister Rosemary Lynch was born in Phoenix, Arizona, and grew up in a Franciscan parish which helped to establish her lifelong vocation. At age 17, she began her first commitment to the long process of becoming a Franciscan sister. She attended Loyola University, where she obtained her master's degree. Subsequently, she taught high school and was later a principal. Sister Rosemary served for 16 years on the central administrative team at the Franciscan Sisters operating out of Rome. In this capacity, she traveled throughout the world as the religious order's chief troubleshooter, as Ed Firmage would say, or does say. 12 years ago, Sister Rosemary came back to the United States to the Franciscan Center in Las Vegas so that she could again work at the grassroots level. In 1977, she was part of a small group that informally started a vigil against nuclear testing at the Nevada nuclear test site, and was involved later in 1982 in formally organizing this group into the Desert Vigil. Sister Rosemary says that she has long been motivated by Gandhi's advice to seek truth and love. Those of us who know her can testify that she is a true disciple of Christ. Sister Rosemary.
My dear sisters and brothers, I really feel free to address you this way because I am a Franciscan sister, and you can all call me Rose if you'd like to. I'm really honored to be with you today. I don't have a paper to read. I would like just to share some thoughts with you, which have been going through my mind for a long, long time, and which I have to say are constantly in a kind of an evolution or a process. Lately, I've been traveling around with the Earth flag, which I have come to regard as a kind of an important icon for today. I'm staying with Dee Rowland, who is a very lovely hostess, and I discovered on her coffee table the beautiful volume that was compiled a couple of years ago of photographs and quotations from the journals of the astronauts. And it is a fascinating book. I love this beautiful photo of our Earth taken from outer space. This book contains many others from all different angles and is filled with beautiful quotations of the astronauts. Just this morning I learned that there have been Mongolians in outer space, Romanians, and all other kind of nationalities. In my narrow way of thinking, I thought, well, they're Soviets and Americans. And by the way, I'm trying to stop referring to us just as Americans. I should be saying citizens of the United States, because I've been discovering that other Americans, people in Mexico and Canada and Bolivia and all around, are also Americans and are a little resentful that we sort of appropriate that term. So I thought it was just citizens of the United States and citizens of the Soviet Union that were going up to space. So I already learned something from just glancing through that book. But it seems to me that when that photo was taken from outer space, a lot of things changed. For one thing, we got a totally new concept of ourselves and of our Earth. I read in Dee's book that one astronaut said, well, I thought I came to the moon to study the moon, but I discovered that I really came to take another look at the Earth. And for the first time, human beings were able to see our Earth. And the only thing that most of those astronauts could say in one way or another was how beautiful it is. There were no borders. There were no false boundaries. Suddenly, it became clear that this marvelous little planet that we have is one pulsating, living part of a vast ecosystem. And I think in these last few days, the marvels that have been coming back from the Voyager cameras, these beautiful pictures of Neptune with this kind of wonderful green haze around it, and the tiny new moons that have been discovered, this is all a great thrill of creation. But it has to do something to our mentality. It has to do something to our soul. The general idea of my talk is supposed to be Christian perspectives on contemporary issues. And even though I've been a Franciscan sister for many, many years, maybe because I've been a sister, I feel very close to many of the contemporary things that are happening, and I feel deeply involved in them. And I feel that they are really my way to God. So I kind of titled my talk, Toward a New Millennium, Vision and Faithfulness. Well, we all know that we're like hurtling toward this new millennium. And I think that we have a real sense that it's not just that we're coming to the end of the century or the end of the millennium, but that we are really coming to the end of a whole epoch in human history. We are coming to that end. And if we're coming to the end of an epoch in human history, we're also in the process of another whole epoch in history. This new millennium, in a sense, is already beginning. Tom said something in his talk about these saints and mystics having changed their way of thinking. I think that's such an important phrase. We know that Einstein told us that the splitting of the atom had changed everything in our world except our way of thinking. And because it hasn't changed our way of thinking, he says that we are drifting towards an unutterable catastrophe. So when I'm thinking of this coming new millennium, I'm thinking, I have to adjust my thought. It's not that there is this new millennium waiting for me or for any of us. It's that we are going to decide whether this new millennium dawns. It's not that there's some, you know, great future out there. It's that we are kind of building this future day by day. So when I'm talking about the new millennium, I'm thinking of something that we are already beginning to construct. Each one of us, in whatever way we are working today, we are beginning to construct this new millennium. Now, if Einstein says that we must develop this new way of thinking or else we're going to drift into this catastrophe, I'm thinking, how is the best way for us to do it? We know that some brilliant people say we can really think ourselves into new ways of acting, and we can. We can read, we can discover, we can think, and then we begin to act. Even a small shift in our mentality is very important because it becomes the source out of which we start to act, out of which our future actions come. But we can also act ourselves into new ways of thinking. And sometimes I believe maybe that's a better method for us today. Or maybe that's the method for older people like me who don't have so much time now to go and read and wait a long time before we start acting. However, I think my main point is that we cannot separate thought and action. And there are some actions that are desperately needed to be taken today. Tom referred to one or two toward the end of his paper about reducing our consumption and things like that, that we are depleting our resources so drastically. We know that Jesus told us to be ready for the coming reign of God. I don't like to say kingdom of God so much because I'm trying to avoid that sexist language today. The new insights of feminist theology are telling us that we should try really to use more inclusive language where we can. So I'm thinking of the reign of God. Jesus tells us to be ready. And in other words, to be acting, to be thinking and acting in that way. And if you don't mind my quoting Abby Hoffman in the same paragraph with Jesus, you probably remember that he told us to live as though the revolution had already happened. In other words, we have to put on new ways of acting, and maybe that will help us in our new ways of thinking. Then I would like to say a few words about our vision. Again, I'm coming back to this globe from outer space, and I'm saying that when the astronauts see that beauty, and they describe it in very poetic ways, as I read in Dee's book, when they come back to the Earth, and when we get a little bit closer to our planet, we begin to discover, you know, the many tragedies, the divisions, the dissensions, the undeclared wars, the terrible pollution problems, these many catastrophes. And we discover that many of these phenomena are not only related, but they're occurring simultaneously all over our planet. There is a very great interconnectedness, which we hadn't seen before. And for me, the Earth flag makes it a little easier to see and to understand. This interconnectedness between all of life, between all of being. But psychologists are telling us that that is still a very immature stage. That only when we arrive at interdependence, when I realize that I am dependent on you, and that in some sense you are dependent on me, then I am beginning to acquire a certain maturity. And this is true also in the spiritual sense. We are mutually interdependent. I am not going to be saved without you. And you are not going to be saved without me. Our being healed, our being reconciled, is not a purely private matter. It is very much a matter for all of us together. Now, I believe before we can understand any kind of a vision that we need, we really do have to take a look at our world today. Many experts are pointing out, and also many people who are interested in religious thought are pointing out that, in general, the human family is facing three enormous crises. These are three great headings under which we can probably put many other problems as subheadings. But we can say that the crisis of poverty in the world. What kind of people are we when two-thirds of the human race are living in poverty and misery and hunger? We're paying the price for poverty in our personal lives and in our national life. It's the number one killer. And it would take too long to go into a real analysis of that. But we know that hunger and homelessness and misery and illiteracy and poverty are not unknown in our country, which is the richest country in the world. Not to speak of what's going on in other countries. It's a real structural crisis in the way the world is put together. We have a hard time in our country even getting our president to approve an increase in the minimum wage law for people, which hasn't, you know, that minimum wage law has not been changed for many, many years. And that made me think a lot about what is our mentality toward the poorest category of people in our country. We know that we have malnourished children in our own country. We know that that slows up their learning ability. We know that for the first time in our history, we have whole families who are out on the street. I know that Salt Lake City has a very good shelter and has been used as a model for other cities, including Las Vegas. Our mayor has traveled around different places and said he's found the better solution here than in any city. But still, even when we build a shelter and we try to take care of those things, we are not looking at the structural causes of this crisis of poverty which is existing in the world. When we look at other countries, we look at the famines that are going on. We look at countries like Central America, where unfortunately our own hands are not completely clean, that we find ourselves in undeclared wars. We find ourselves supporting regimes that, you know, are far from respectful of human rights and things like that. We look at countries like Bangladesh and India that suffer one calamity after the other, but are still big clients of our weapons trade, our weapons export. We look at the third world debt, where countries owe us billions and billions of dollars, but when we analyze that, we discover that actually what they have paid back exceeds the amount of capital they borrowed, but because of arbitrary interest rates and so on, which probably all business people understand better than I do, they are still not able to liquidate those debts, and this is a great calamity. We still have a certain standard of material wealth in our own country, but it has really not produced happiness. Last May, I was in England, and the Thatcher government had some kind of a poll going on in the country, and the poll revealed that people in Britain are wealthier than at any time in their history, but they are unhappier. They're unhappier. And they also have crime and suicide and drug problems and things like that, despite the fact that they're, if they average out their per capita wealth, it's greater than any time in their history. So we see that there are a whole lot of things in this complex of poverty, that it is really a great crisis. And I'm suggesting that it is also a spiritual crisis. Somehow or another, we as the human family have got to figure out a way out of this crisis of poverty. Then the second great crisis, which is also going to affect our vision of what kind of a world we're going to have, is certainly the nuclear threat. And probably to that we have to add the, you know, the chemical weapons, the biological weapons, this whole, you know, militarized zone up here that continues to agree to produce these things and finance the production of them and so on. I think that if we do survive as a human family, and if our planet survives for another 100 years, and we manage to overcome this, I think people will look back and say, what kind of human beings were they that they could produce those things? What kind were they? You know, what kind are we as a human family that we can dedicate so much of our national treasure, of our human treasure and our material treasure, to the production of those dreadful things when we have this crisis of poverty on the other hand? We already have vast nuclear arsenals, and we're planning more. We know that our military budget is exorbitant. We're making airplanes that cost $500 million each, and we think it's great if they can actually get off the ground and fly a few hundred miles. You know, we do have to ask ourselves, what's going on with that? And for me, this is also a very great spiritual problem. Maybe I've been affected by living so long near the nuclear test site and by organizing and participating in those vigils and fasts out in the desert. which is, I think, a beautiful moment of mysticism. The desert has always been the great place of testing for the prophets, for Jesus himself, who was tested in the desert. But anyway, I think that that's a massive spiritual problem. I think that our nation, and probably other nations as well, we are being tempted today. If we can remember those temptations of Jesus and how Satan took him up on the high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and said, you can have all of these. But there was a price. Falling down, you have to adore me. And I think that's the temptation that we have today. We also can have all the kingdoms of the world with our bomb, with our wealth, with our influence. But the price is pretty high. The price is pretty high spiritually for us. I think that those basic sins of pride and greed are really not overcome. Fortunately, we've begun to ask some questions. We as a people, we've been saying, you know, is this too much? We don't like this, what's going on. We want the comprehensive test ban treaty. We're happy that the climate is better between our country and the other superpower. We're delighted about that. We're beginning to ask, have we laid maybe too much on the altar of those gods of metal? Are we paying too high a price for that? We're beginning to ask those very serious questions. So I think the next great crisis, which is also, I think, a profoundly spiritual problem, is the ecological crisis. Many experts say we have not even reached the catastrophic peak. But see, we didn't pay very good attention in the 1960s when Rachel Carson came out with her beautiful book, The Silent Spring. I call it a beautiful book because she really appealed to our consciences there, but we didn't take it so seriously. In the 1970s, there was the big environmental conference in Sweden, and it was declared an urgent problem. We didn't take it so very seriously there either, probably because there were so many of our prophets linked some way or other to pollution. But now we're in this crisis. Where are we going to get clean water? Where are we going to get clean air? What about the contamination of the soil? Cesar Chavez for years has been fighting pesticides because they were injurious to the workers. And now he is showing they're injurious to all of us who eat the table grapes because the pesticides have penetrated the root system and actually into the body of the fruit so that we are at risk when we're eating those table grapes. They contain very harmful pesticides. So we see more and more that what I think our beautiful planet flag reminds us of, we are part of this whole great web of life. And I think that's a big challenge to our spiritual life. If this beautiful earth, this whole universe, as we're now being reminded by these photos from Neptune, has been placed in our care, we have also been placed in the care of our Mother Earth. And it's to our great damage that we have disregarded this link that has bound us. And so we see that we have turned vast portions of our planet into deserts. And we have changed climatic patterns in very serious ways, you know, through our really destructive behavior. We've learned that we cannot damage one part of an ecosystem without everything falling out of balance. You know, I'm not a big scientist like perhaps some of you are, but, you know, today doctors are saying the human brain is itself an ecosystem. Just one little chemical thing goes out of balance and we can't think, we can't behave. We become erratic and do all kinds of bizarre things because our ecosystem has been disturbed. And each of us is part of this marvelous web of life, of all creatures. And if you don't mind at this moment that I bring out my patron, St. Francis, a beautiful medieval saint who understood this relationship, this familyhood of all creation. For him, the sun was our brother, through whom we praise God. We didn't have to abandon this beautiful creation. We praise God through our sister, Mother Earth. Painful has been our treatment of her. Through our sisters and brothers, the animals and the flowers. His life is so inspiring on this point and so contemporary for us. He gave us perhaps our first hints of what kind of a rapport we could have with creation and of the interconnectedness of all life. Today, in more modern times, we look at the writings of Teilhard de Chardin, the divine milieu, how beautiful. and of other theologians coming along, like Matthew Fox with his notions of creation spirituality, Thomas Berry. He says that what we're discovering today about the created universe is perhaps the greatest revelation that's come to the human being since perhaps the realization that of one, the one true God that came to us through the revelations, chiefly of Jesus. So Thomas Berry is pointing out something that perhaps a few saints and mystics understood in the past, but that we're only barely beginning to grasp. But I think once we understand the dimension of these three great crises, we can begin to have some kind of a vision. We can begin to say the world can be more just. We know that injustices are producing those wars in Central America and in Africa. We only need to look at South Africa and the calamities that are going on. It is a question of justice, which is a profound moral problem. So we want a more just world. We want a more peaceful world. We don't want military intervention. We learned a terrible and painful lesson in Vietnam. I'm not sure how thoroughly we learned it. We had the opportunity to learn it. We have not yet, I think, come to terms with Vietnam, and it's my personal feeling that as a spiritual healing, until we just simply kneel down and say, forgive, we've goofed in Vietnam on many levels, that we're not going to find healing. But we see that the whole problem of war and conflict, unless we go toward reconciliation, is so destructive of our human psyche, of our human spirit. And we're beginning to see more and more that we have to have this cosmic relationship with all of creation. Because without it, we cannot have that more just and peaceful world. So for me, these are such spiritual problems, which, however, present us with the new great challenge. We can create more just structures. We can go towards more peaceful solutions. We can take seriously the problems of ecology. We can begin, as we simply must, to look at alternative ways of living, whether they will necessarily result in more people becoming monks or nuns or mystics, I don't know, but certainly an alternative lifestyle is going to be a path to healing and probably a path to deeper happiness for all of us if we can, you know, begin to set ourselves on that. And I think if we've got that vision, it's going to make, you know, really big demands on us. And that brings me to my third point, which is faithfulness. How are we going to be faithful to the various religious traditions, the various beliefs, the creeds, and everything else that we've grown up with, if I'm suggesting that we really have to undergo some radical changes? We want to be faithful to our call. But I'm saying that in this day and age, we have to be faithful not only to the past, but we have to be faithful to the future. And somehow or another, that statement means a lot to me. How do I become more faithful to the future? This beautiful book that I discovered in Dee's house is dedicated to all the children in the world. And that is the future, and their children, and their children. We know that Native Americans are not supposed to make any decision without reflecting how it's going to affect the next seven generations. They're not just talking about our children and our grandchildren, but the next seven generations. And that's the way that we have to start thinking about the future. It's probably going to demand some change in the way that we look at ourselves. Is it fair to say that in our country, we're inclined to define our personal worth by our possessions, by, you know, how many things we have, maybe even to look on all those possessions as some kind of a sign of God's blessing on us, which really doesn't follow when we consider that Jesus didn't even have a place to lay his head. So we have to say, what's going to be our... what's going to be the way we look at ourselves? What about our spiritual attitudes? Are we going to take this notion of interdependence more seriously? That I really do need the welfare and the happiness of the poorest country in Africa before I can be healed? Or the poorest family in my city? That I have to be concerned about that? It may even bring us some rather radical changes in our whole notion of God. I keep thinking to myself, what image of God allows us to build and store those dreadful weapons? We somehow are able to reconcile all those things. We know that Jesus brought new understandings of God, away more from that God who was a judge and who, you know, was a destroyer and an avenger and the angry God, much more to the loving, the compassionate, the forgiving God. Jesus brought a radical new understanding to the notion of God. Are we going to, for our age, have some kind of a redefinition of God? I think that's being faithful. And I think that that's what the mystics call us to do. They enter into this relationship with God, the relationship of love and forgiveness, and that is an enlightenment. There's a theologian named Sally MacFaig, and she has written a book called Models of God. And she says, an image, she's talking about images of God, an image is no longer relevant when we forget that it's just a metaphor. And I think we have forgotten that some of our images of God are really just metaphors. And we've kind of stuck with those. So I'm saying that the new insights that we need to go into the next millennium are going to represent a quantum leap in our spiritual life. And our faithfulness is going to demand that, what may be really a quantum leap, that we're going to take much more seriously our call to forgive, to love, to share, to find other ways of dealing with creation. It's going to be a personal and a societal change that will have to come if we're going to get into that new millennium. It seems to me that right now we're at a kind of a low point. I believe that, you know, scholars and historians that go back to the origins of our country, in looking at the American experience, say that we haven't really kept faith with our origins. And maybe we're being called there to take that faithfulness into the future, the faithfulness of our origins, which perhaps had a little more inspiration in them than many things that are going on today. Robert Heilbronner, the economist, has a beautiful paragraph in which he says that it's a terrible thing to have lost one's sense of participation in the spiritual journey of the human family. And I think that if we can begin to be faithful in new ways with a much more cosmic view of our spirituality, that we will really not only rejoin the spiritual journey of humankind, but perhaps take some steps towards becoming more profoundly mystical in our own spiritual development. Thank you very much for staying awake. I think it wasn't easy for you. We've had a long session. Does everybody want to at least stand up for a minute because you've been sitting still for an hour and 15 minutes? I don't know if Tom's prophecy that I was going to say a lot of things that were kind of contradictory to him was true. I do think that I have a little different perspective on many aspects of the spiritual life. But at the same time, I think that many points that he touched would really support quite well the things that I've dealt with in my talk.
You want to ask some questions? We'll open the time up for questions.
How would one manage, and I guess there's no easy answer to this question, but the economic dislocations that would have, that would result from cutting back our consumption? You know, we're a society built on consuming things. If we cut back on armaments, there's people that are going to suffer. If we cut back on cars, there's lots of economic problems that would result from that.
Yeah.
That's one part of my question. The part is, what about the divisions in the world? Religion seems to have some part in that. At least when we look at Iran and things like this, fanaticism, how do we overcome that sort of thing? As individuals, that seems to be a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah, you asked two great big questions. Well, first of all, on the whole, economic dislocation, first of all, we should be looking and planning. A long time ago, I heard that it was really required that the United States government have a conversion plan for every single military facility. But we tried for years to find the one related to the Nevada test site. And finally, somebody sent us two or three little tight pages, which really said nothing. But apparently, there is some kind of a requirement that military facilities have an alternate plan. And there are groups around the country that are really taking seriously the study of reconversion and, retraining and things like that. I am not an economist, but I think somehow or another it's really no longer a matter of choice. That is not a very good reason for promoting this dreadful degree of militarism that we have in the world, to say that we have these jobs. When we look at what's going on in the country, that the whole infrastructure materially is falling down, bridges and, railroad lines, and the cities are a mess, the streets are cut up, they're covered with glass, and parks are dying and things like that, it seems that there would be work for people. That we do really have to readjust, first of all, our priorities some way, and maybe our spiritual condition. They've been saying in Los Angeles that in X number of years, I forget the exact number, 20 or something like that, they have to reduce the number of cars by X number of millions, and people will have to develop a quick and cheap transportation. We haven't taken seriously public transportation, and now we're all married to our cars. I'm the same way as everybody else, but I couldn't move away from this place where I am living and working to go do anything if I didn't have the use of a car. But when I lived in Rome, I never drove the car. We had one car for 40 people. So guess how often you got your turn? We took the bus. So there are ways of doing it. And I think that with the pool of concerned persons that we have in the country, we really should be able to find the way. See, I'm all absorbed in this space book that I saw. We found the way to do all that because we had the will to do it. I think we lacked the will, really, to get in and do it. And it will require, I think, some very real winding down of our material expectations. And the very thought that, we might have to find other ways of traveling is already chilling to most of us. But, I have to say, we're going to have to do it. We don't really have a lot of choices on that. And then on that other, it's no answer. I'm only thinking along with you. I'm no good at answering questions, but I love to get them, and, we can all comment on them. I'd be surely interested in hearing somebody like Dr. Firmage or Tom or whoever is, more learned than I am in those fields comment on that big problem. But on those religious wars that are going on, they're really tragic. To me, it is such a prostitution of religion to use it as a way of violence. However, when we get down to the roots of most of it, we discover that somewhere it's a question of human rights. I think it's largely that in Northern Ireland. I think people basically feel that if they're Catholic, they're in an occupied country of Protestant English people, and that, it's a question of human rights. It's an old thing, 400 years old, and it's a hard way out. In Israel and Palestine, it's a question of, very deep proportions. It's not just only a religious question. If it were, it would probably be simpler to settle. Ed, you can help us out here. Thank you very much, Ed. I know that the Department of Labor every year releases statistics about the military sector producing the least jobs per dollar than, five or six other categories, and we don't ever take that seriously. But thank you very much for that. It's really encouraging. And maybe that's connected up with what I say about the new mentality, that we just absolutely have to take that first step. And then we act ourselves maybe into the new way of thinking. Again, I said I'm not good at answering the questions, but I keep up a dialogue with our congresspersons from Nevada. We don't have very many. Well, I went to see Harry Reid at the time he was congressman. I've seen him often, but this one particular visit was just before the Marine barracks was blown up in Lebanon. And I went with another friend of mine, really, because we said, you've got to bring those Marines home from Lebanon. And he said, now look here, just over there, I was talking to President Jamil, and he said, our troops are needed. We said, what are they needed for? They're sitting down in those bunkers using six-month-old rations and getting sick. How can they be doing anybody any good? He says, see, you don't know. He said, I go over there and I talk to the... He gave us this story. 3 days later, the Marine barracks blew up. We were pleading with him to do, you know, use his influence as a congressperson to bring those soldiers home. Well, then we went back to him. He had a hard time looking at us. And we said, well, we're on another subject. We won't say we told you so. But one big military appropriation was just coming up for a vote. And we said, you have to vote against it. And he got all defensive again. And this man is our friend. He gives us time when we ask it. And he said, look, don't you know that 500 jobs in Henderson depend on that? And we said, for 500 jobs in Henderson, you're willing to escalate the arms race that threatens the extinction of 6 billion people? So I know exactly what you're saying. I think it, you know, it is such a strategy that parts of one particular plane or missile or whatever are built in about two-thirds of the congressional districts all over the country, so that all those congresspersons feel they have to vote for it because that number of jobs in their constituency depends on it. And that's why I say we have got to have this new mentality that, and maybe Ed's statement about we have to take another step, I think we have to continually work on those congresspersons. I know I don't seem to be able to vote the right people in either. You know, I always say the candidates, my vote seems to be like the kiss of death. I don't know. I don't get them in. But we do really try. We work on them. We lobby them. We're now saying Central America seems to have a peace plan. We should not obstruct it. We've had numerous examples of people who have been there, congresspersons themselves that have been there, saying we must let them at this point work out their destiny. That seems really hard for another whole group to do. But I agree with you. I think we do have to continually lobby and continually, you know, work on our congresspeople, you know, and maybe talk to a lot of people about these ideas.
Can I make just one comment? I think the number of men and women who have been involved in the monastic life have really not had that much of an influence upon the economy. And that this is really an individual thing, that each of us can make the decision to reduce our level of consumption. And I doubt that that would have... I suspect that that this would be spread out over a long period of time in terms of the number of people that would make this decision. But the fact is that each of us can make that decision. We can make the decision to reduce our level of consumption, and it won't have that big of an effect upon the economy.
You know, Tom, when you say about whether or not the monks have had an effect, of course, in their early years they did. They in a completely agrarian society. They were the highway department and the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Learning and a lot of other things. In contemporary times, probably not. But I think that we can have impact. There are groups all over the country that are banding together. You're perfectly right when we say we have to start with ourselves. But we have to do it also cooperatively. And there are a lot of small steps that we can take. Probably you could get together and have a how-to session with folks. You know, that is really a very important question, because I think you know, the way you phrased it, is it possible for organized religion to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem? And we've certainly seen through the ages parts of the problem. When I say we need to break out of, you know, kind of our present spiritual attitudes and get into some new ones, I think we can also influence our churches. I grew up in a Catholic church which looked quite different from the Catholic church of today, which certainly was a lot more rigid, a lot more closed in. After the Second Vatican Council, things did break open. And so now we have a completely different outlook on many, many things. Also, I've been participating in some meetings in Europe in which the churches of Eastern and Western Europe, Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, have come together and have focused on these topics of justice, peace, and the integrity of the creation, and are really like animating their people in the very terms of the things that we're talking about today. So I do think the churches are, beginning with my own self and my church, we are in desperate need of conversion, but I think we're capable of conversion. I think we need conversion. I think we need conversion to go into the future. We need to have, free ourselves of a lot of this baggage that, in order to be faithful to the core of our belief, which is to really listen to the message of Jesus, to discover that, how do we work it out in this militaristic, wasteful, destructive, violent society? Maybe not the way we've been doing it. Maybe we just need to find new paths to be faithful to that core of the gospel. And so I think that religions and faiths can do that, if we will undergo this conversion process and really say, what kind of manifestation of our core of our faith do we need to move into this new age? We got to start today. It's my idea.
Any other questions? I guess our time is up, and we appreciate your patience.
Thank you very much for staying, even to the bitter end. I really appreciate it.
Is this water for us, Tom?
Sure.